Pippa Jones on TRE.
Now, to my first guest, one of my favourites, and I know that certainly one who polarises opinions. Some love him, some hate him. Well, whatever it is, I know for sure that if he is nothing if not thought-provoking. Today we've got a double dose of him, and I'm delighted to welcome Tony Gosling to the programme.
Hi, Pippa.
Hi, Tony. Let's start with the EU, with the impending referendum, with Brexit. I find myself thinking that I've found how I feel about it, and then listening to something else and thinking that maybe I don't feel that way about it. But what I do know for sure is most of the media that we're served up tells us what they want us to know. And there are always other things going on behind, which is why I've asked you to step up and present those to us.
Well, there certainly is loads and loads going on behind. In fact, it's been going on behind really since, I would argue, since 1944, actually during the Second World War. I was reading recently what I think is one of the best books analysing the end game of World War II. And this guy, Paul Manning, that wrote it, I was put onto this book by a guy called Harry Beckhoff, who is a conservative. He was the longest serving member of the Conservative Party. He lived in Marlborough in Wiltshire when he died at the age, I think I'm right in saying, 98, 99. He died last year. We went to his funeral, in fact. But he put me onto this book, and he'd been working for MI6 in World War II, doing denazification. So I thought, well, you know, you don't often meet people like this, and I should really probably pay attention to what he's telling me. And he just said, look, have you read this book? And I said, no. And he said, well, if you haven't read this book, you don't know what's going on. And I was immediately a bit sceptical, Harry being quite right-wing, but picked up this book by Paul Manning, and I discovered actually he was somebody rather close to my own heart. He was himself a journalist. He'd been working actually for CBS News during World War II, conveying much of what was going on in the Second World War to the American public daily, really, from Europe. You know, as being a CBS radio's commentator for the war as it was happening. You know, obviously, the Americans entered the war in 1941 because of Pearl Harbor. And from that point on, you know, they were very much keeping track of what was going on in Europe, knowing that at some point that they were going to have to commit a lot of their troops and forces to the European war. And they were having to make big decisions about, you know, how much to commit to the Pacific War, how much to the European war. But anyway, Paul Manning's book really does spell it out, how the Nazis operated in occupied Europe. It was saying basically that the German banks, led by Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank, what they were doing was, before a country had even been invaded, that the German banks would be buying up large amounts of stock in the banks of the countries that they were about to occupy quietly. And bankers being what they are, they didn't make a fuss about, oh yes, such and such is buying our stock. You know, they weren't making a fuss about that. But the point being, the big French banks, for example, they owned vast amounts of the stock in stocks and shares in French heavy industry. So what was happening was that before the troops would even arrive, what was happening is the Germans actually were owning large amounts of big industry factories. And when the troops turned up, often they avoided bombing these factories for obvious reasons, because they sometimes had a majority share in these industries. And so, you know, once they arrived, they would immediately become what was called part of the cartel. Now, one of the main cartels was IG Farben, but they ran this cartel system in Germany whereby when any of the big industries bids for a contract, whether it's an armaments contract or, you know, any kind of normal sort of civil engineering contract, because the industry is part of a cartel, all of the different factories and different companies would all get a share of the contract. Yeah, so it's a complete fix, basically. So the idea of any kind of competition was out the window. Although there would be various bids would be put in, and it would be on the face of it a competitive bid process. At the end of the day, there was an agreement to share out the profits and the contract amongst all the people in the cartel. And this was the process that they operated in all of the countries in Europe which became under Nazi control. And in his book, Paul Manning spells it out. He said what they wanted was a common market right across Europe for these cartels to operate, so that there shouldn't be any kind of trade barriers. So he's, I mean, there's lots of other stuff he says in his book, because he did a lot of investigation into Nazis in South America and the recrudescence of the Nazis after the Second World War. That is to say, what happened to all the wealth that they got from the whole of Europe. But for me, reading this just the other day, you know, rereading it, this whole thing about the common market, which is what we got into in 1973, was actually the same system that Manning had been writing about. Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's treasurer, had set up in 1944 to carry on after the war. Because obviously, 1944, after D-Day, and after particularly the Falaise Gap battle in France, where there was a whole sort of denouement where it looked like the Germans might actually push the British and the Americans back. You know, anyway, they didn't. And at that point, there was this thing called the Red House meeting took place in Strasbourg, which is a sort of half Switzerland, half France and half Germany. And it was, you know, that was where they all got together, all these German industrialists under Bormann's direction, and set up this this whole system whereby the wealth would be squirreled away around the world, most of it in South America, a lot of it obviously in Swiss banks because they're very, very close by and they were making a lot of money out of the war. And so I think what we're dealing with today is this sort of, you know, when they talk about free trade, what they really mean is they want the big banks to be able to come in and buy up everything. And a colleague of mine, Finian Cunningham, is a writer who's he's Irish, but he lives out in Ethiopia. He wrote a fantastic thing last year, really describing the attack on Greece from the German banks. Because as Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek finance minister at the time, then he's now become almost like a pop star, kind of going around the world talking about how things really work. Of course, you don't see much of him on the BBC, but he's explaining really what the same thing as Finian Cunningham is explaining. If you go online, you can find a book, an article by Finian from last year, talking about the Panzer banks destroying Greece. And this is what has been going on. So, I mean, I think what we're looking at here is an economic empire, a financial empire, which was actually created by Nazis at the end of the Second World War. And if you look, just as one very, I mean, I haven't seen this discussed anywhere on any of the discussions about the EU since this referendum was announced. 1973, we went into the common market. Obviously, it was a common market. It wasn't a political union, which it's now become. No one's actually been asked about that. But no. If you just look at what's happened to, I'm not just talking about British industry. I'm talking about industries in most of the periphery of Europe outside Germany, is they have been dismantled. They've been taken over and dismantled. And, you know, I think basically the game is beginning to be up and people are realising, well, actually, this whole common market EU game is not for us, you know, and it's not doing us any good. And it's particularly the Eurozone, you know, with the Euro currency, has just been used as a trick by the banksters to suck dry the economies of other parts towards Germany. And I'm not blaming the Germans per se at all. I'm saying what you've got is a banking cartel system. You've got banksters running things in Germany and in Switzerland who are just running everything for private profit, for private gain, and the politicians are way down the food chain, Pippa.
That's certainly very comprehensively explained, I may say, and certainly a scenario which is very hard to deny, to negate. The fact is that Europe seems to have been a cunning plan, if you like, to get to a point where this could happen. But, I mean, let's look at now, let's look at today, and let's look at the idea of Britain being in or out of Europe. How does that fit into the stage that you've set there, Tony?
Well, I mean, I find that a lot of the characters that are calling for Britain to get out of Europe very unsavoury, personally. And I think that a lot of them are thinking this for their own kind of jingoistic reasons. But I would just say, well, look, you know, if we want, I mean, if 1973, when we joined the common market, Britain was probably the leading industrial power in Europe. I mean, we had heavy industries galore, and heavy industries was what the German banks wanted to control. We had the heavy industries galore. We had obviously steel industry, we had aircraft manufacturing industries, car manufacturing industries, all this stuff. Now it's all gone. And I ask, you know, I live here in Bristol. We've got, we had at the end of World War II, Filton Airfield. And Filton, the Bristol Aircraft Company, amongst others, who were based at Filton Airfield, a big airstrip on the north of the city. We were producing, at the end of the Second World War, more aircraft than anywhere else on the planet. I mean, a lot of them were actually prefabricated in kind of secret locations around Bristol, then brought to Filton to be assembled. Now we're in a situation, we have nothing there. What if you drive past the old runway, which closed 2 years ago, all you can see is just big piles of rubble piled on the runway to stop any aircraft landing on it, which seems a bit silly. In case someone needed to land there on an emergency landing, they'd hit rubble, you know. And that's where Airbus is based. Now, they've got other sites around Europe, but one of their employees pointed out to me in their annual report a couple of years ago, they said, well, look, here's the annual report of Airbus, and they've got a map of all of their plants in Europe, and Filton isn't even on it. So there's Toulouse and the other main Airbus plants. They obviously think of Filton, where there is still some manufacturing going on, as peripheral, and it's going to go soon. And for Airbus to produce an annual report that doesn't even include Filton on their map, and then to say, oh, well, it's very important, you know, we really care about it, you know, they don't seem to. I think, you know, we've just got to wrest our sovereignty back from Brussels, because Brussels is in some way really making big strategic decisions about where our industries go. So, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of real drilling into this. I suppose, I mean, if we're going to have a successful nation, we need to be able to plan for ourselves. And in the past, we've made quite a good job of that over the years. I mean, in fact, maybe some would say probably a too good a job, especially the sorts of, you know, attacks and bullying and genocide we've done in other parts of the world to get our empire. But all the time you're being run effectively by something called the Round Table of Industrialists in Brussels, which is, I mean, if any of your listeners have never seen it, I would recommend go online and find a documentary called The Brussels Business. It's really chilling. I remember sitting watching it. It was on RT a couple of years ago. And you can see how it all works. The Brussels Business is all about lobbying. It's done by a great little organisation, Dutch organisation. I think they may have moved to Brussels now, but they were originally in Holland, called the Corporate Europe Observatory. And what they've done there is they've shown you how laws get made in Europe. And it's nothing to do, really, with the MEPs at all that we elect. Mm. It's this thing called the European Roundtable of Industrialists. And one of the most astounding things in that documentary, again, which has never been shown on the BBC, it is where they have a report by, I can't remember the name of the company. It's a giant, great civil engineering company, Kier or somebody like that, have done this kind of report, which is where they say, oh, we think that all the main motorways in Europe should look like this, and we need to change the network and add a few motorways here and there. And it's all done by this big private civil engineering company. Well, they show in the documentary how the European Commission sit around twiddling their thumbs. They don't really seem to do anything other than desktop publish the report from Kier into a European Commission report, just changing the logo, effectively taking out the fact that it's written by Kier and just calling it a European Commission report. And this is where what we're going to do with our roads. So you can see what's going on there is, it's effectively big corporations are just telling us what to do. None of these corporations have ever been elected. They're all super rich, and it does rather explain why ordinary people, and particularly poor people, are just being left on the back foot, and why a lot of people point at the EU and say, well, actually, this is a kind of soft fascist organisation where it's just run like a kind of dictatorship or oligarchy of the super rich.
I mean, would leaving the EU be a step towards Britain being able to distance itself from that sort of centralised power?
Well, I think so, yeah, definitely. The only thing is, of course, you know, there would be, I suppose, a bit of scrabbling by the English elite to still kind of try and dominate society here. But at least, you know, it would mean something when we elected an MP to Westminster. I mean, one of the main problems we've got in our politics, really, is our political parties are dominated by money. And that's not just the case here in Britain. It's in many other parts of Europe, too. Although some countries are sensible enough to have systems where, although it's really galling, there's public funding for political parties and that they can't take money from industry. And you know, it's annoying to think that part of our taxpayers' money is going to fund political parties we profoundly disagree with, but it's also quite a mature and fair system where they get money per vote. So everybody that votes for a party, whether it's left or right or in between, green, whatever, even communist, that some of the state money proportion, according to those votes, goes to that party. And so there's a, you know, you're voting, not only giving the party a vote, you're also giving them the money to campaign, to survive, to research. And this is what, you know, one of the most important things that politicians can do is spend that money on research and on basically hiring journalists, people like me, to look into things so that they can ask the right questions. Because, you know, that's one of the most effective things, actually, politicians, apart from helping out their constituents in when the government is, you know, destroying people, evicting people, or doing something it shouldn't be doing, is actually to be keeping their heads around who's running things where and why, and also providing some sort of research into a vision for the future. So,
Without the influence of industry that those donations
lobbying is an absolute disaster right from the word. I mean, look what's happening with the health lobby here in Britain at the moment. I mean, we've got this kind of wave of propaganda around vaccines. Well, of course, the big, I would call it propaganda because there's been no particular increase in the amount of children getting meningitis. But what we have got is we've got drug companies who've got patents on these meningitis vaccines who are finding that the National Health Service is not prepared to pay for meningitis vaccine for everybody at any time. And so they're effectively lobbying through the BBC, through the media, to say, well, we want to make sure that every kid has this meningitis vaccine because we care about the children. No, I don't think that's really why they're doing it. And the NHS has made the clinical decision that, yes, you can have this meningitis vaccine, but only at a certain point. And we're not just going to give it a blanket to everybody. I mean, all you need to do is go back a couple of years to the swine flu scare. See, it was over £1 billion of our money was spent on this Tamiflu vaccine, which all it did was it ended up, was purchased by the government in a kind of scare tactic fashion, ended up sitting in warehouses until it had gone to its sell-by date, and then it was destroyed. But this is where we are now, is that power of the lobby is far greater than the power of common sense, and the media are simply not doing their job in scrutinising what's going on and exposing it. I mean, I'm in touch with a guy called Tim Tate who lives here in the South England, and he worked for First Tuesday and Granada TV, making investigative documentaries, and he was explaining to me on the show I do here in Bristol how he now pitches ideas to dispatches on Channel 4 about potential documentaries. He had a really interesting load of documents given to him which showed that the Boeing aircraft were being fitted with faulty parts which weren't actually manufactured by Boeing, and that Boeing were doing nothing about it even though they'd been told. So, you know, the idea the next time you get in a Boeing and it's flying across the world, it might have a, you know, a window in it or something that's really a Boeing window, yeah? So he pitched this and showed the documents to the BBC and Channel 4. Well, Channel 4 said, we don't do documentaries like this anymore. And the BBC didn't even reply to him. So you can see what's going on with investigative journalism in Britain. It's been absolutely stamped on. I mean, the thing is, people do want to watch it, as Roger Cook proved in the 1990s. And he's another one that got sidelined and elbowed out in the run-up to the September the 11th attacks. It would be interesting to see, wouldn't it, what Roger Cook on the Cook Report would have made of 9/11 and some of this terrorism that's going on now. Yeah. They would have really, I think, with a whole crew of investigative journalists that they used to have at Central TV, looking into these things for us. Our eyes and ears, Pippa, have been closed really since around about 2000. And a lot of what our governments are doing, not just nationally, internationally, around the world, I mean, look at what's happening at the moment in Yemen. I mean, absolutely horrendous. Yeah. And we had David Cameron yesterday actually applauding how wonderful arms sales to Saudi Arabia, really? Which are being used to massacre innocent civilians. Yeah. Well, I think maybe he's losing it, and maybe the Saudis are losing it too.
Yeah. Well, look, I would love to continue with that subject, but I can't, because we're talking about big fat cover-ups, and we've got one coming up which I want you to speak about. Just stay put while we take a quick break.
Pippa Jones on TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.